Hi, I'm Magda.
And I'm Katie, your co-host.
How We Built Our Team is a podcast that talks to successful founders and leaders in the hiring and recruiting space to learn their strategies for building and scaling their teams.
From attracting and impressing top talent to creating a strong company culture, our guests will share their insights and experience on what it takes to build your dream team.
Today, we have Jessica Haria on the show with us. She's the current founder of Logic Loop, which she founded to help operations teams never miss a critical event. Previously, she helped top 10 banks automate lending at Instabase, a $4 billion company, which she started out of her research at MIT. She started as their founding engineer and then later built their product function from the ground up, which we will be, of course, diving a lot into. She also built data transformation software at Trifacta and Google Cloud Data Prep. So we're super excited to have her on the show. And I'm also welcomed by Lavanya, a customer success manager at Dover. So Lavanya, do you want to introduce yourself really quick?
Yes. Hi, everybody. As Magda mentioned, I work as a customer success manager, helping teams use Dover to build and scale their own teams. Super excited about this podcast and interested in hearing what you have to say about building your own team, Jessica.
Thank you. Super excited to be here.
Awesome. I just really quickly want to dive in and ask you about your background and how you got from Instabase to Logic Loop. What made you want to go from building this product function from the ground up to then building your own company?
Absolutely. I feel like entrepreneurship is very much something I saw around me my entire life. And they say, you know, if you hang around the barber shop long enough, you get a haircut. So my dad is a founder. My then boyfriend, now husband, is a founder. Some of my best friends are founders. There's something I very much saw around me. I saw sort of the power of being able to bring something to life that you would imagine. And at Instabase was the perfect sort of breeding ground for that because it was born out of some research that we did at MIT that had a lot of context about like what the story was before the company. And I joined as a founding engineer. And when you join that early, you're not actually joining, even though your title is a founding engineer, you're just joining as a founding person. And what that means is you notice things that aren't working and then you want to go in and help them and fix them. And sort of unknowingly realized it was actually the best place for me to learn how to do customer success and do a little bit of sales. And as the company was growing, we realized there was this deep void in between sales, customer success, and engineering that traditionally product sales. So I actually volunteered and actually campaigned for a whole year for us to have a product function, which is a whole set of other things that I'm happy to chat about as well. How do you like campaign for the first X at a company? How do you know it's the right time to have a function? And seeing and building that function from the ground up very quickly, we were joined by other product people. We actually helped hire our boss, the head of product management there. So that was a really interesting journey. And realizing that once we do it once, you can do it again is basically what led me to leave Instabase to start Logic Loop about something I was really passionate about.
That's super interesting. Obviously, you've experienced building a team as a founding PM almost, right? And then scaling your own team at Logic Loop. Curious to hear, what are the differences between scaling a team at a startup that you're non-founder of versus then, you know, hiring people from scratch and building your own thing?
I do think overall there's more similarities than differences. But if we are talking about just the differences, I think as the founder of a company, you have the opportunity to not do something about it. Like you were making so many more decisions to even decide that you want to hire a PM or you want to hire your first salesperson. And versus when you're working at a company, that is sort of given for you. I think what does stay the same is you have to be scrappy no matter where you are. I think you have to be even scrappier if it's your own startup versus someone else where you can like rely on the founder's halo. And, you know, suddenly you realize, oh, like I'm the founder. I'm the one that needs to be inspirational and magical and charismatic and all of these different things. If you're working in someone else's company, you can sort of offload that charm onto someone else a little bit more. And despite that, I think in both cases, part of being scrappy is always being on the lookout for like who in your network is a really good fit for these roles. And I feel like that's like something that doesn't start when you want to make the hire. It starts when you join a company or you're starting to think about the company. It's like, one day I want to hire this person as my PM.
That's great.
And any lessons perhaps you've learned? You've done this, you know, a few times now, building teams from scratch. Any lessons that you've learned that you wish you knew earlier?
Yeah, I feel like the number one thing that I've learned that is a little bit like that I've never thought about before this is that you want to make friends with coworkers that are both, you know, of course your age, but also much younger than you and much older than you. And that's something I literally never thought about in my 20s. I was just hanging out with the other people. They were also free to hang out on a Friday night and had nowhere else to be. But sort of realizing that, like, having friends that are much younger than you and much older than you can actually help form your company. So, you know, I went out at the stage where a lot of my friends have families and mortgages or bank jobs. So they don't want to start companies. So they definitely don't want to be the first engineer at companies. But the interns that I worked with at my FAPTA, my first job, are now at the stage where they want to be the founder engineer somewhere. So having, you know, a portfolio of people at different stages of their life actually just makes it more likely that you'll be able to attract someone at the right stage. In contrast, for people that are much older than you, that's a great opportunity for you to pull them in as your head of sales or your VP of engineering or whatnot. So I'll say that's like one sort of counterintuitive thing that I literally never thought about that I learned. And then the second thing is that just the first X role is truly the hardest to fill. So the first product manager, the first account executive, the first engineer, I feel like is a tiny bit easier from like an understanding what to look for perspective. At least it was for me because I've been an engineer before. But if you haven't been professionally doing a role, it's really hard for you to know how to hire for that. What does help is actually just adopting a beginner's mindset. Like, this month, my job is to figure out how to hire versus my job is to figure out to actually hire this person. And I feel like just having that like educational mindset allowed me to reach out to a lot of other founders, get access to a bunch of resources, and also be okay making mistakes if your first hire is not what you'd hoped for because you weren't sure how to evaluate them. I think a lot of founders and early stage folks are just hard on themselves. I think it's okay to make mistakes as long as you're open with the person you hired about it.
Yeah, I completely agree. That honesty is really key. And that leads into my next question too. You spoke a lot about networking, meeting people and sort of building relationships over a long period of time to sort of make sure that you have a pipeline when you're ready to hire that person. I'm curious to hear how you established trust outside of networking with like for people who maybe applied on inbound. How do you establish that trust, especially with a team that is super well connected, knows each other for a long time? How do you build that sort of culture at your own company?
Yeah, I think a large part of the trust happens like before someone signs up to work for a company. That's inherently a very high trust decision that they're making. What is always helpful is I let someone else speak on my behalf. So a lot of times trust is built when, you know, your investors talk about you, and we've definitely had everyone at the company we've hired so far, our investors have actually spoken to them. In some cases, where appropriate, getting customers to talk to them as well has been helpful. So it's saying actually having other people vouch for you even before they join your company is actually a huge signal of trust. And I actually want people to ask, like, what is Jessica not good at? Because if that's something that's out in the open, then it's not a surprise to them. And I'm hiring them because I'm not good at everything and I want them to do things that I can't do, either because I don't have the time to or the skill set to learn how to do that. So I feel like actually being very open about these are our strengths as a company, these are our weaknesses, and these are my strengths as your boss and my weaknesses. Can you help me with that? Is actually super helpful. Everyone who actually starts at Logic Loop has basically a human user guide that they write about basically things like this. Things about what the pet peeves at work are, how they like to work, how they like to communicate.
Something that is really interesting, as almost an aside, in this sort of like hybrid world, even if you work in person, you probably have customers or other coworkers that are that you're not physically in the room with all the time. So actually understanding what someone means when they type that Slack message, something even as simple as that, right? That can erode trust so quickly. Like, she is kind of like curt, but maybe that's just how she writes messages, right? That's the communication style. They're even being explicit about that, maybe awkward initially, but it just gets all of this other stuff out of the way that, like, you don't want to erode trust for the wrong, and I might even say dumb reasons. So that's been really helpful. And then, of course, you also hire high autonomy people and set up processes such that the question of trust is almost irrelevant. Like, it's very easy to have trust in a high transparency environment. Because you know that you will know when things aren't working. So I don't have to be micromanaging or asking my reports, okay, is this thing done yet? If you just have a process where every week you update the spreadsheet of sales numbers, I don't have to go ask you.
Love that. Would love to hear a little bit more about the guide that you just mentioned. I think it's almost like we should do it. I think it's obvious, but I haven't heard anybody else do it. So can you please share what this guide is? Is it a written form? How do you facilitate it when somebody joins?
Yeah. So it's part of our onboarding docs, and it's literally, I mean, we are really low tech about this. It's literally like a Google Doc. You could put it in Notion, wherever it is. But actually what you do is whenever you join the company, you add it at the bottom of, you add your section at the bottom of this. So you have to actually read everyone else's guide before you get to yours. Right. So that's one way of forcing people to like understand who all these other people we're working with. And then I'm actually happy to send a template over after as well, like a human user guide version. It's got some questions that are pretty standard. And I think depending on the way your company likes to work, you can add in other things.
Love it. Love it. I think this is a good transition to our next question about company culture. So how do you define company culture? How do you think about it?
Yeah, totally. One of the biggest learnings I've had around this is that no matter what you think and you want your company culture to be, maybe in reality, it's going to be like 80% of that or 100% of that. Like, you always want yourself to be better than you actually are. And I still think that there's nothing wrong with having that ideal. I think it's completely fine to, you know, have the culture say something that maybe you're not living 100% all the time. And I don't think we should put that kind of pressure on ourselves as startups to like completely do 100% of our activities in accordance with like all company values. That being said, values are really, really important to us at Logical. And we actually had a deck of company values even when we were just the founders, which is something that like doesn't happen. You typically write it before you make your first hire, then make it seem like you have some culture company values before they actually join. It's just the reality of how a lot of things work at startups. But for us, it was really important to be on the same page about how we make decisions, especially at startups, because we're making so many decisions under uncertainty, where the equal and opposite of what we do is also super valid. So what gives us then the ability and the confidence to say, this is what we go with, it is a set of values and it is a set of principles that we come up with. So we have this as a deck. And of course, when someone joins, we go through it with them. And I specifically do this with every single hire, even if they're not on my team. As the CEO, I feel very personally responsible for talking about these values. There's a bunch of different values that are like more and less important depending on the team. Some teams just will operate a little bit differently. Go-to-market versus engineering tends to be a big one. But there is one central value that makes it very easy for everyone to remember. And this is our North Star value, even if we forget everything else. So for us, it's business impact and asking yourself every day, am I doing the most important thing that I can be doing today? If everyone at Logic Loop can answer that question as a yes, that's all that matters. And then there is the teamwork, ownership and growth, speed and urgency, rigor, all of these other things. One thing that we did that was interesting was we actually had two values that sort of contradict themselves. So we have both speed and urgency and rigor as our values. And one might say that if you're rigorous, you tend to be slow, you know, or vice versa. And we've actually found that to be not true at all by challenging our employees to be both rigorous and expedient. We've actually gotten the quality of work we expect at the pace we do expect. And it takes a little bit of nuanced explanation to get into it with a new employee. But we reaffirmed that with our Slack channel. So every time someone actually does something in accordance with one of these values, we explicitly celebrate it throughout the course of the year. And then every time we meet over offsites, we have the, sort of this like circle of complimenting each other at the end of the offsite that actually ties it back to each value that we've seen someone exhibit.
Oh, I love that. Would love to hear, how did you put these values together? Did you sort of like sit in the room one day and talk through what's important to each one of you? Like how do you come up with the list that you have? And how do you come up with the North Star?
So the North Star was something that I think we came up with honestly way before we founded the company. This is why Jackie and I do what we do, is because we want to be impactful. We didn't start Logic Loop because we wanted to raise the most amount of money possible. We didn't start. There's all of these other things that we could be starting companies for. But I do think that there's like a kernel of this that comes from founders, and the rest of the stuff around it actually is very much shaped by the early team. And I expect that whatever we have right now, it'll change over time. But I do think that companies don't stray very far from what's actually important to the founders, no matter how big they get. There's just this like top-down, trickle-down effect. And instead of like sort of shoving that, we just lean into it. We're like, okay, this is what we value, and this is what like anyone we hire that we would love working with likely values as well. So given that the North Star value was set, all of the other values, we actually do a like annual review of them. Like, is this still how you operate? It may not be, and it may not actually work for us to do this when we're, you know, a Series D company, but we reevaluate it every year.
I love the idea of it being sort of a retro of like, do these values still matter for us? Are people still thinking about them the same way? It should be a living document, which I think is a great idea. But pivoting just slightly, we talked briefly earlier about building up the product team at Instabase from the ground up, but can you talk a little bit more about hiring that first person, what that process was like, especially because the product function was one you had advocated for? So you clearly had a vision for what you wanted it to be like.
Yeah. I think a lot of the first offs are born out of a lot of pain. It can be different for different companies, but for Instabase, it was very much that we're hearing something from a customer and implementing it. And that was it. That was like the entire product development process was that. And we could do that at the sort of sizes of contracts we had because we sold into larger banks. And it actually was economically worth it to throw not just one, but multiple engineers at just solving a very custom problem. But you sort of zoom out a little bit. And then as a shareholder, you realize, like, I want this company to exist in the next 10 years. And of course, the founder is doing a great job with that. But then you sort of realize that you need that intermediate product layer to say, okay, where are we going long term? And how does what we learn with one customer make it easier for us to get and make that one successful? So I feel like the reason that the product always was born was actually coming from like a pain of like, we were doing too many custom things at some point because we could. And we saw that we did, if we asked ourselves 5 years from now, is it easier? We weren't really sure that the answer was yes. Would it be easier for us to like attract a new customer and retain them? The answer wasn't very clear that it would be yes. So it sort of came out of that. And the advocacy happened because as a lot of engineering orgs sort of tend to, and Google's very famous for this as well, they're like very much an engineering-driven culture, even though there's PMs, but it's sort of like we do what the engineers want and the PMs sort of like write the documents around it. I think the first PM is particularly tricky because the first product manager is an extension of the CEO's vision. And it's the implementation of that CEO's vision
into a set of products, features, or processes that the customer can benefit from. Often, actually, the first PM doesn't necessarily have to have a PM background. That's something that people also miss sometimes. I sort of assumed that, yeah, a first PM could be anyone else but me because I was not a product manager by trade. But actually realizing that the job to be done, which is, again, a very popular sort of product management framework, is actually something that someone on the business side or the tech side, particularly if they were early at the company, has good intuition around, makes it much more palatable for that first person, even if I don't know how to write a product requirement doc. So if your job to be done basically can relate to something that the business team, so your first salesperson or your first customer success person, probably has a ton of context about your customers and about what would make for good product features. Similarly, your first engineers probably have a lot of context about what would make for natural extensions to the product. And one of my mistakes was in thinking that the first product person has to be a product person before. And it's not to lead the smoothest H1, H2 planning process. It's none of that. It's literally to be an extension of the CEO's vision. And that can come from a lot of different places.
I think at Dover, we've done something very similar. All of our PMs are actually old engagement managers and customer success managers, or even people who ran operations of, you know, some of our teams who understood our product and our core offering very well. And they know the product in and out. So obviously you've been a founding member of the PM team in the past, and now you're a founder, you've been scaling your team. How have your leadership side evolved? I know you mentioned that you like to hire people who, you know, you can trust, who, you know, are self-starters, but was that something you recognized right away, or was this a learning journey?
What's really interesting is that I started off very much, you know, leading by doing, as most first-time managers, right? Most first-time managers manage something that they have done before, right? Typically, that's the case, right? So if I'm an engineer, become an engineering manager, and that kind of thing. The running, you know, thought process with that is that you actually have to be, you feel like you have to be better than the person that you're managing at their job. I quickly realized that as a founder, you can't do that. That is just not possible. And you're explicitly hiring someone because they're better than me at their job. And because they've done this job that I haven't done before. And I actually still initially resisted that. So initially it was like, oh, okay, I'm hiring my first salesperson. And I actually need to be really, really good at sales. I need to learn all the things about it before I actually make this hire. To some extent, you need to understand a little bit about the role you hire for. But you have to get to the acceptance and the clarity that you probably won't be better than them at their job. And once you have that clarity and acceptance, then you can actually lead from a different place. You lead from I know what you're doing better than you do, but then you set up processes to, again, allow them to be autonomous, do what they need to do in the process that works for them best. I think, and also detach yourself from the how and attach yourself more to the what and the why. I think that's like one of the biggest personal learning growths I've had to do is I was attached to the how because I always had like a very strong opinion of this is how we do things. And now I'm starting to just focus on the inputs and the outputs and being there to actually viewing myself as someone explicitly just there to get rid of bottlenecks instead of to do the work myself. Still, I've only led people who are ICs. I haven't led managers. Also, I bet there's like another step that's waiting for me to learn.
Yeah, it's so hard when it's like your company and it's your baby and you don't want to give up that control and not know if you do it this way, it might be wrong. And then the stakes are much higher for you. So it obviously makes sense that relinquishing that control is really difficult. But in terms of building the company structure for the engineering department with Logic Loop, obviously it's an incredible product that's used by a lot of tech companies. And you, I'm sure, have a ton of talented engineers. So how did you bring on engineering talent? That's something that we're hearing that startups are struggling with a lot right now. Engineers are really in demand and there's a lot of top talent out there. So how do you compete with bigger companies and bring engineers on to your team?
I think the short answer actually is that you don't. If you're competing with bigger companies on their home ground, you've already left. Like, we cannot pay more than a Facebook does. We don't have the brand that a Facebook does, you know, things like that. So you actually stop trying to be someone that you're not. And no one's like this perfect circle, right? You always have certain edges somewhere, right? And if you're a unique person, you're a unique company, you have either a point of view that someone else doesn't, or you have a network that someone else doesn't, or you have something that someone else doesn't just because you were you and you've had these unique set of experiences. And so we lean into that. So the first one is, of course, we started a conversation off with this, which is like networks. Networks from your college, from your second degree people who know people that you know. Investors are actually pretty helpful with this as well. And you have to pre-select for someone who wants to work at a startup because that's actually one thing you can't change about someone. You just can't. They're too, I fundamentally think that there's different types of people. Doesn't mean that you only hire from all the startups. You want to make sure you can hire from people who come from larger companies, but you want to make sure that they're explicitly interested in the experience that you'd offer. And the other thing is that, you know, people, of course, like all the time talk about how big it is to hire from their first networks. But sometimes you don't have a network. And now what are you going to do? You can't like go back 10 years in your life and recreate all of that. So you've got to have a plan B. And the plan B is honestly just an unabashed numbers game. There's a ton of cold emailing that actually still works still today. And the other thing that actually does help is content. For some reason, so Jackie, our co-founder and CEO, wrote up a post about our technical challenges and actually getting our SOC 2 Type 2 certification. And we did this when the company was really early. We had some like unique things to say about it. You put up a blog post, and so many engineers referenced that blog post. And we didn't even think anyone would read it, or we don't even know which shows up, but it does. And that's actually really valuable. The other thing that I did when we talked about this a little bit before was we actually wrote a really unique Sony 6090 document and made that part of the job description. So actually, if you like still, I don't know if the posting is up, but it's, in the past, there was like this founding salesperson at Logical Loop sort of description, job description, but it came with a full document about all of the things that Jessica thinks about. And I bet you could recreate that on the engineering side as well. And that honestly humanizes it a little bit. No one's used to reading a full document full of like diagrams and explanations and a statement about passion. But we did it because it felt authentic to us. And so many people referenced it. And even if they don't work at Logic Loop, they remember it. And that's good enough for us. Or they might reference it to a friend of theirs. And that's good enough for us as well.
You mentioned cold emails. A lot of people don't know, but you know, cold emails do really well. Dover is the entire product on that. I definitely see a lot of, you know, our customers see so much success through it, especially because some customers may not have a network in the area that they're looking to hire. And people may not be looking to relocate. So there can be so many reasons, even if the founders are well-connected. Acquisition is one thing, retention is another, with yeah. startups especially. I think people stay as they're learning and they're growing within the company. So how do you at Logic Loop ensure that people are continuously growing individually as well as, you know, there's learning taking place in the organization as a whole?
Yeah, totally, totally. And an early stage employee at a different startup at Instabase, this is something that's been close to my heart because I've been on the other side. And I understand how much of a gamble you're taking to go join these set of people that are just trying to do something. But the way I think about it is there's like these like concentric circles of support, if you will. So it might start from your manager or a team. Oftentimes, there's not even a team. Maybe you're the only person in that role. It starts from the manager, then the rest of the company. And then the last circle that almost no one thinks about as much is externally as well. And I'll go into these. So the first thing is, how can me as a manager, how can my team, you know, support other members of the team? Actually, the same 30-60-90 that I talked about in the recruiting process, we actually keep it, there's continuity there. We actually, the four someone signs on the dotted line for their job offer, we go over it. This is what you will be doing in the next 30-60-90 days. And this is how we think about this role, knowing that it can change, of course, and you know, we're open to doing that. But just so that there's no surprises on either side. And we're like making the blanket statement that retention is always good. Sometimes retention is not good. Like sometimes you want to know within 30 days this is not working out. And it needs to be a non-awkward conversation. It needs to be something that you like understand is an experiment going in. So we have that and then we stick to this and then every one-on-one that happens weekly, we actually will review that document, how we're making progress against it. And if there's explicitly certain areas where I'm not giving my team the opportunity to shine, my team will bring it up and say, hey, you told me I need to take X number of cold calls, but we haven't gotten a system to do that. Can we fix that? So it's like a living and breathing way of having conversations. The second thing is actually getting the entire team involved in someone's success. So for us, actually, we have an excellent collaboration team, go-to-market and sales, and our salesperson actually learned a little bit of SQL. So he can do some demos himself and he can like pull up some data himself. And that's like giving him a chance to grow in an area that he might not if he were in a larger company. In fact, our earliest engineers, 1 month were given the task of generating five sales leads each. Right. So that gives them the opportunity to, of course, maybe they're not becoming a better engineer, but they're definitely becoming more valuable in the workplace as a result of having worked at large group, but explicitly being encouraged to do these things that are outside of their day-to-day role. And the last piece of it is this is where investors can help as well, where some of our employees actually have taken advantage of these like mentorship sort of groups and programs. So First Round, for instance, I know has this fast track program. Excel, actually another of our investors has put some of our team members in touch with other folks as well. That, you know, wouldn't be afraid to actually go ask people outside of your company. Because for instance, our solutions engineer, there isn't another solutions engineer at our company. So he goes and gets mentorship from a top solutions engineer lead at a different company through these networks. And they can offer him all kinds of like career development stuff that I don't even know about. And then he tells me, hey, this is how I've seen other solutions engineers develop. How can we allow for that in a larger group? So I'd say those are the three layers by which you can actually grow and retain your employees.
You know what you said about the cross-functional work, I think that's such a great idea because I think it's not only developing a new skill set, but also getting empathy for your other team. I think sometimes, especially like when you're in customer success, it's very easy to say, hey, product isn't building what I want or engineering isn't doing the thing that I want. And then maybe vice versa. The other team can think that, hey, this, you know, the role is busy and customers are different than they actually are. So I think that's such a genius idea to also just build trust within teams and understand how each other's job is harder than it sounds.
You sort of have built this culture of, if I don't know the answer, I'm going to go to an expert and I'm not, like, egos aside, we're going to get the answers that we need and we're going to spread the knowledge throughout the company, which I think is just really great. In terms of also retention and making sure that your teams are well supported, I'm curious, the diversity, inclusion, that's a really hot topic across the startup and hiring space right now. I'm curious about how you tactically put that into play at Logic Loop. How do you think about diversity? How do you factor that into your hiring process?
I think we have a natural advantage here. Having two female founders of color really helps, right? Like you seed the company with what sort of diversity of a specific kind? Now, I will say we both did do computer science. We did go to good university. So we like don't have a different kind of diversity in our founding team, which is also important to people. And I actually think I want to shout out to Dover. I feel like Dover's done a great job in having worked with the team of having people with such different backgrounds come together. I know one of the customer success folks that we worked with at Large Loop from the Dover side like was a music major. It was like that like is exceptional, right? But back to Large Loop, I think the founding team, the more diverse it is, the better your odds are. The investors. You can actually ask for diversity in your investors as well. So our investors
are one, a man of color and a woman. Often your investors are your first team outside of the founders. That's something that you can think about and should and ask about. And then in terms of actually making the first few hires, I will say it is hard enough to hire anyone as it is, but you can absolutely put in extra effort in the top of the funnel where, or at least look for places where there's likely to be a lot of underrepresented talent. There's a bunch of, you know, Slack communities these days that I know and I'm aware of, like She's Ready to Dev. There's a few others that I can't really remember. There's a woman in sales group. There's a ton of meetups. So I actually feel like these days it's easier more than ever before, at least when I was starting my career as an engineer. I was very used to being one of 20, 25 engineers that was a woman. Now, I think that number is maybe not 50-50, but a lot better. And I think there's a lot of places where you can, if you source in the right places, if you're looking for talent in the right places, it actually makes the rest of the pipeline a lot easier.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And obviously, I think to your point, we haven't heard that advice before about starting with your investors. That is, you know, the first team you build, and they have a lot of input into who you hire and how you hire. So I think that's a really good point. But we've reached the end of our conversation, unfortunately. I could talk to you all day, Jessica. This has been awesome. But before we go, I just want to ask two quick last questions. One being, do you have any final tips? You've obviously given us a lot of tactical advice, and I can't wait to include the templates you talked about in our show notes. But do you have one last tip for startup founders to leave us with today?
I think I'd just like to emphasize something I already talked about earlier, but don't be afraid of being who you are. And it sounds so wishy-washy, but really, you cannot win on someone else's battleground. You cannot win on things that you're not good at, right? So just like understand, like it comes from clarity and acceptance. Accepting what you're good at, bad at, having the clarity to actually articulate that. And then having the confidence to be like, this is who we are as a company. This is what we do well. This is what we need help with. Actually goes a long way in everything, in like attracting the right kind of people, retaining trust with them. You never want someone to be less excited after their first week at your company than they were when they started.
Yeah, that's awesome. And last question is, what is the last book you read that really inspired you or stuck with you?
Oh, man. I read books? Well, I don't. Okay. There is a book that actually influenced my decision to start a company. It's not actually a book as much as it's an essay, and it's called The Myth of Sisyphus, which is by this philosopher, Albert Camus. And the TLDR, I mean, there's a lot of like good stuff he writes and that I like don't think I even understand till date. But the TLDR was that a lot of us wait for the meaning of our life to come to us, or like, wait to then discover it. And that was something I definitely felt before I started the company. It's like, wait, like what am I meant to be doing on this planet Earth? Why am I here? And the book actually helped me clarify and understand for myself. My purpose is what I decide it will be. So I could just pick something and say this is going to be it, and it will be it, and I'll be happy with it. So I think it like sort of helped me bring back the power to like, I don't know what I should be doing with my life. To actually, I don't need to know. I just need to decide. And the decision is much easier than the discovery for a lot of people. And that's really helped me.
Yeah. Mic drop. That's awesome.
Love that.
Cool. Well, Jessica, it's been awesome chatting with you, and I can't wait for our listeners to hear this episode, and we'll talk soon.
Yeah, thank you.
How We Built Our Team is produced by Dover, a recruiting operations platform that helps you attract and engage the best talent.
You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else that you listen to podcasts. See you next week.